So, the we dealt last week with the relationship between the detailed civil laws that the whole of Mishpatim was about, and how they impact our spiritual growth, so that those civil laws are not given us to create a just and a civil society, that we would do in any event. The civil laws were given to us as Torah, and as such they're part of our spiritual existence. They're not part of it, they're not there to create a social community. That's that we would just do as social beings. We would create community, as all sorts of other civilizations have done without the Torah. We don't need the Torah for that. What we need the Torah for is to find in that legal system that Mishpatim outlines spiritual growth. And we discussed last week and came up with some interesting definitions. We spoke about the power that exists when you contain a force. And the force we were talking about containing was the force of Chemda. And Chemda, we said, was ego-related. So by containing the ego-related activities, which generally express themselves in two arenas, which are the two arenas in which the ego expresses itself? Sorry? Sexuality and money. Right, the material world and sexuality. That's where the ego expresses itself. Primarily, there are offshoots of that in other areas. So can you have ego in learning Torah? Of course you can. If the purpose of the learning of Torah is for self-aggrandizement, then that's egoistic as well. But the two main fields, the productive fields, where ego works well, is in the area of building wealth and in the area of building family. That's where you need ego. But the ego has to be contained and it has to be managed. And what we learned last week was this fascinating idea that when you dam the ego up and you build a reservoir of egoistic force that you don't let out, then your spiritual potency and your emotional potency is far higher. And we talked about the difference between a dissipated human being and a human being who is contained. The disciplined and contained human being has much more emotional and spiritual power than the dissipated human being. And we discussed that. We spoke about the image of the dam and having water in the reservoir, the bank account, and having money in the bank account, and how much more powerful that is than when that's all allowed to run. And we talked about the power of bris as that which holds polarity in equilibrium. So if you've got a very strong polarity that could destroy, where the two poles could destroy one another, then bris is what holds that polarity in equilibrium, and it results in the creation of a buildup of potential energy. And that potential energy becomes very powerful and very forceful. So think of it even in the case of bris, of a covenant between nations. So you've got Russia in the days of the Cold War, and you've got the United States, and there's a bris that kind of keeps them from wiping each other out. So what happens to each while they're not dissipating their energies in wiping each other out? If they try to wipe each other out, that would be the end of both of them. Even the victor would have dissipated so much that there would be no power left and some new power would rise. But while the bris was in place and each was holding itself back and restraining itself, it built up more and more power. And there was fear. There was a sense of awe, of understanding on both sides of who knows what's on the other side. We don't know. But they're building up and they're building up and they're building up, so they must have something. So this mystique about what was building up is much more powerful than the reality of letting it show. And we spoke about the male and the female forces and how in the 10 Sephiroth they can line up, as the Sefer HaYetzirah said, and how they... how the Shnei Luchos HaBris also work that way, the two covenants, and that's again a bris that you have between them. And we really worked a lot on Lo Tachmed as the last one, where the Ramban says in the beginning of Mishpatim that Mishpatim is all about Lo Tachmed, and the Ibn Ezra says that the whole idea is to constrain our passion for things that aren't ours so that we can direct our passion in investing in things that are ours. That's what ego is meant to do. You can use your ego to invest in that which is yours, to make it better and stronger, or you can use your ego to try and get that which is not yours. And the whole of Mishpatim, the whole of Choshen Mishpat, all the laws of Noshim and Nezikim, which we spoke about, are designed to create, to set those boundary lines of what we call Rishus HaRabim and Rishus HaYochid, the boundary lines that we use on Hilchos Shabbos, interestingly enough. What is your property, what is my property, and what is public property? And they're different realms. And we act differently in each realm. We act differently in our own if I'm in my private property, I act differently from the way I act if I'm in your private property. And if I'm in public property, I act differently again. We change we adapt to the reshus that we're in. And we understand that this property, which is public property, which I'm entitled to use but not to damage, there's property which is private property, which I'm not even entitled to use even if I don't damage it. And there's my own property that I can damage also if I want to. I can do what I want with it. We have different relationships with the things that are depending on what rishus they're in. Are they in your rishus, in my rishus, or in public rishus? And when an object transfers from one rishus to another, it now has great spiritual ramification. Because if Ari's pen transfers to me, what happens spiritually? What halachas does that change? So it used to belong to him, now it belongs to me. So there are laws of ownership that change. But what else changes in terms of what we discussed last night? I can start saying, I love this pen. I really love it. Mm-hmm. I'm so happy it's mine. I can't say that when that's there. That's lo tachmed. That's transgressing the 10th commandment. So it's not just about a monetary relationship that changes. That my ability to invest rather than covet. That's what we use. We use chemda for one of two things. You can use chemda to invest if it's yours. And you can use chemda to covet if it's not yours. And covet is a destructive force. And investment is a constructive force. Investment builds your assets. And coveting dissipates your assets, your spiritual assets. Now, we're going to take this a whole lot further today.
Don't get
if you're up for that. Well, we'll see at the end of the day. we'll take it a whole lot further if you're up for it. So the next parasha starts off with the Da'avre b'nei Yisrael v'yichu li trumo me'ez kol isha she'ivrein liboy. Take a donation from anybody who wants to give it a donation to build the Beis HaMikdash, and we start with the whole building of the Mishkan, all the different kelim of the Mishkan, how they're to be built, what they are, how they're to be used ultimately, and so on. So this is now introducing Mishkan, which is yet another Rishus. We're not familiar with this Rishus. We know about Rishus HaYochid, which is private domain. We know about Rishus HaRabim, which is public domain. We know there's a difference between your private domain and my private domain. So we understand those domains. But Beis HaMikdash and Mishkan is a whole new domain. It's not public, it's not private, it's different. It's Beis HaMikdash, different kind of domain. It's a fourth domain kind of. And that's what we're going to look at in Parshas Truma. The Rashi further on makes the comment that this is kind of in the wrong place because the Torah has just been given. We went through all the Mishpatim and everything. Bnei Yisrael say, we accept it, we're happy with it, we love it. Then what happens? Then Moshe comes down, and then there's the golden calf and the breaking of the luchos. And that all happens when? On what day of the year? Shiva Osa B'Tammuz. So Shiva Osa B'Tammuz is not a fast just because that was the beginning of the breaching of Yerushalayim. Got to go further than that. Shiva Osa B'Tammuz, the root of Shiva Osa B'Tammuz is the beginning of the Yom Kippur process. That's why we really fast on Shiva Osa B'Tammuz. We give some historic meaning to it to give it more texture, but the reason we fast is not because of a historic event. The reason is because we understand that historic event, which started the process leading to the destruction of the temple, was because of things we have done wrong at our source, never mind later on, and at our source that goes back to the very first Shiva Osa B'Tammuz, which was the time of the eagle. That's when that was. So that's what we're going back to in Shiva Osa B'Tammuz. And Shiva Osa B'Tammuz to Yom Kippur is a whole build-up. And that's why the atmosphere of the year changes, the atmosphere of the calendar changes, starts getting serious, there's Shiva Osa B'Tammuz, and then there's the 3 weeks, and then there's little break, and then it's Elul, and then it's Rosh Hashanah, and then it's Aseres Yimei Tshuva, and then finally it's Yom Kippur. That's all the build-up. From Shiva Osa Betamis to Yom Kippur is all the build-up. From Yom Kippur and Sukkot all the way to Pesach, that's another kind of an atmosphere. So Shiva Osa Betamis was the breaking of the Luchos. Yom Kippur was the final Slicho, when Moshe goes back to get the second set. And it's only after that that the instructions for the Mishkan are given. So, and that we learn about in Ki Tiso. Why is it over here? So Rashi says, Ein Mukdam U'Mucha B'Torah. We have a principle that the Torah is not written chronologically. There are parts of it that are written chronologically, there are parts of it that are not written chronologically, and this part was not chronological. It's not written in historic order. That's all fine, but then why was it put here? Understand that it's not necessarily chronological, but then there must be some other reason why the Ribbono Shel Olam put this over here. If it's not chronologically in the right order, it must at least be philosophically in the right order. Because the Torah is a book of philosophy, not of history. It's a book of life. It's a book of principles. It's a book of a worldview. So in terms of constructing the worldview, this must be the natural next step. Why is that so? Well, based on last week, we can understand it. If Mishpatim was the teaching us the mechanism to build our own spirituality, the Mishkan teaches us how to build national spirituality. So Mishpatim Lo Tachmod is the way we build our own spiritual force to be able to project spirituality outwards. Don't forget, we often talk about the fact that a human being is a generator of energy. We're a generator of human energy, of mental energy, of spiritual energy. This energy can be detected with instruments. It's not something that is it's kind of airy-fairy. This energy can be detected. It doesn't even have to be detected on your head. That we know already. They can put instruments on your head and your brain can create all sorts of electromagnetic things that you see on a screen. So that's an electricity. So we know there's something that's coming out, that there's an energy that your brain is creating. Not only that, but you can modify the waves that you see on that screen by modifying your thinking. And you see what control you actually have of this energy you're putting out. And you know, people are aware of the fact that cell phones give out energy. Of course they give out energy. People are worried, is it destructive energy and what does it do for health? And we don't know. But it gives out something all the time. It's giving out something. And when you're in a room with a whole lot of cell phones, you know, there's all sorts of energy going on for sure. But you don't need cell phones for that. When you're in a room with a whole lot of people, there's a whole lot of energy going on. Is it constructive or destructive? Depends. It can be very destructive energy. And you can develop the sensitivity to feel the energy. To walk into a room and say, the energy is good here. And to walk into a room and say, the energy is negative here. To be interacting with a person and saying, this is a good energy person. And interacting with another person, and this is a negative energy person. And to try and get away from the negative energy people, and to try and stay with the positive energy people, and to make sure that you're a positive energy person. And when you come into an interaction, you're putting out positive energy. And how do you do that? The whole Lo Tachmod principle that we learned last week is one of the ways you build up positive energy. Because if you're with Chemdo, you've got negative energy. If you're looking at people thinking all the time, I wish I had what he had, I wish I was doing what he was doing, that's a terrible drain of energy. But when you're walking into a place and you're completely happy with what you've got and there's nothing more that you want of anybody else's, that's a very calm and tranquil and beautiful energy that you put out and that people can sense if people are sensitive to it. Now we're working on national energy. How does a nation, how does a community of people build this level of spiritual energy? And that's what Truma is about. The Beis HaMikdash as a generator of not just of national energy, of global energy. The Beis HaMikdash is a place that takes all the energy of the globe, the spiritual energy of the globe, and brings it to a center, and brings Hashem's energy down, and transmits it to the globe. It's our connection point with the Ribbono Shel Olam. So we really are studying, in these parashiyos, we're really studying that point of connection between Hashem and us. And what is a word, and perhaps even more than a point of connection, I like to use the word the synchronization, because that's when it connects. It's not just connecting in a passive sense. It's not just connecting like you've got two wires and you touch them together and now there's a connection. That's not how it works spiritually. Spiritual connection only occurs when the two poles are synchronized. Then you've got spiritual connection, and synchronicity needs some effort. It needs some work. What is the Hebrew word for synchronization? And this is not one of those cases where I'll say you'll kick yourself for not figuring it out, so I'm going to give you time to figure it out. You won't kick yourself for not figuring it out because you probably won't figure it out. And it's just my suggestion. But this is the way I translate the word aid as synchronicity, synchronization, not as witness. Because aid is the Hebrew word for witness. But what do we have? How does our law of evidence work? You've got to have two. Mm-hmm. Why do you have to have two? Because they've got to synchronize. And if they don't synchronize, it's not aidus. And what is mo'ed? What is a beit va'ad? Your house should be a beit va'ad l'chachamim. What does that mean? Where chachamim come together and they synchronize their ideas in your house. That's what a beit va'ad is. That's what a va'ad is. What is a mo'ed? When a time period synchronizes. And we're able to synchronize with the history of that time. What is an ohel mo'ed? What is the ohel mo'ed? It's the Mishkan. And what's the Mishkan? Where God and the people are synchronized. And what is the luchos ha'edus? In this parsha in Truma, you've got to put the edus inside the orin. What is that? That's the synchronization. So edus to me is about synchronizing. Evidence is just one of the many synchronizing. That's why the same word, mo'ed, edus, vad, all of these words are various different forms of synchronization. But synchronizing is what's really important. And what we're going to learn about here is, and we're only going to have a chance to really analyze the Orin, which is perhaps the most important point of synchronicity between God and the people. So that's where we're going to focus most of our attention tonight. So just as we have the different rishuyos in Chosh and Mishpat, in civil law, we have these different domains, and they need to be clearly defined. I need to know whether this pen is Mr. Streit's or the pen is mine, because that affects how I relate to it. Do I relate it with investment or with coveting, or may I covet it or may I not? May I enjoy it? May I not? My whole relationship with the object depends on knowing whether it's mine or not. And at what point does it become mine? There's an instant at which it becomes mine. That's the instant of Kinyan. So all of that are the laws of Chosh and Mishpat. But now we come into the area of Hamavdil ben Kodesh L'chol. And this is an area that is foreign to modernity, and particularly to American modernity. Hamavdil ben Kodesh L'chol. Chol and Kodesh are separate. Now that doesn't mean there's no integrity between them. That doesn't mean that there's no overarching principles between them. But you can't even begin to synchronize something that isn't first separate. Synchronicity requires an acknowledgement and an identification of difference before you can come to togetherness. That's the essence of synchronicity. And we see that in many cases in the Torah. One of the most beautiful cases we see it are in the laws of Taras HaMishpacha, where it's necessary for a couple to constantly redefine themselves individually so that they can synchronize themselves as a couple. It's not a one-off thing that you do. A couple meet, they fall in love, they synchronize forever. It isn't that way. Synchronicity comes and goes. It's a wave. So that when we talk about a moed, the yomtiv, it comes, and then it goes, and it comes back, and it goes. We synchronize with Hashem in all sorts of different ways. Shabbos comes, Shabbos goes. Synchronicity is a wave movement. It's a to and fro movement, an ebb and a tide. We see many cases of the Torah where it's necessary to have that separate identity very clear before you can even talk of any kind of synchronicity. And it was quite interesting, on Friday evening, Dr. Gift was telling me about my father making a big deal once when he was giving a shiur at the University of Cape Town, and Dr. Gift was present, and he asked for a piece of chalk to write on the blackboard, which is what they used to use in those days, and somebody gave him a used piece of chalk, and he said, "That's a piece of chalk like this," and he looked at it very disparagingly, and he said, "That's okay for a medical lecture, that's not okay for a shiur. I want a new piece of chalk. And I suggested to Dr. Gift that the reason that he said that was probably not because he wanted a new piece of chalk and he's not going to start. He didn't want a piece of chalk that had been used for chol, because this is Kodesh. And it's different. You don't use your tefillin for chol and then use them for Kodesh and then for chol again. When you're finished with your tefillin in the morning, you put them back in the bag and you don't use them again until next evening. And if you need a leather strap, you don't go to your tefillin bag and pull it out and use it. We don't do that. We keep these identities separate because that's part of polarity. energy comes and requires polarity. Spiritual energy requires spiritual polarity. Polarity means separateness. If you bring them together, you short-circuit the whole thing. What did we say? Brit was keeping them apart. You insulate them, you keep them apart so that the power is there. And Kodesh and Chol also are two poles. They're both energies. Chol is an energy, and Kodesh is an energy. But those energies have to be kept, to be mavdil. You've got to be mavdil ben Kodesh l'Chol before you can really synchronize the energy and create something great. So here we start talking about the energy and the domain of Kodesh as opposed to Chol. So if you think of it, the Mishkan or the Beis HaMikdash, there's already a separation between the Mishkan and outside of it. Outside the Beis HaMikdash is Chol. As you walk into the area of the Beis HaMikdash, it becomes Kodesh. That's why what's happened at the Kotel is so tragic. And people go to the Kotel and they love it. I go to the Kotel and I do Kriya. And I don't do Kriya because we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. I do Kriya because of what the Kotel has become. Where's the Mavdil ben Kodesh l'Chol? Where's the Mavdil? Do the people there look any different than the people at the Tacharan Merkazit? Do they look any different than the people at the cinemas? Are they dressed differently? Do they behave differently? Do they act differently? There's no Kodesh. There's no Kodesh at all. The Kodesh has been destroyed. So there's a wall. That's not what it's about. It's about being able to access Kedusha. You can't access Kedusha when the human energy is Chol. You can access Kedusha when the human energy is Kodesh. And that's why we have to be careful in our shuls. What we speak about in the shul, when we speak in the shul, how we dress in the shuls, how we behave in the shuls. And that's why men and women sit separately in a shul. Because outside in Chol, they don't need to sit separately. That's one of the things that defines this different domain. That in this domain, men and women are separate. There's that polarity. And that polarity is observed. And if men and women are together, it's not Kodesh. That doesn't mean there's anything wrong with men and women sitting together in Chol. There's nothing wrong with men. It's the most natural thing for men and women to sit together. But that's not Kodesh. When it comes to Kodesh, then it's got to be separate. And so we've got to create in our shuls. It's not just enough to have a Sefer Torah and Aron HaKodesh at the front. The human energy has to be an energy of Kedusha. And there are a whole lot of halachas that define how you do that. How do you create Kedusha in a space? And there's a whole Torah around that. There's a whole area of halacha. And halacha is not just do's and don'ts. It's how to create spiritual energy. It's interesting, the Asians understand it. Americans don't get it, but Asians understand it. Feng Shui, what's Feng Shui? How to create spiritual energy in a space. And they've got certain principles as to how to do that, to create just the basics of a flow of energy. They're not talking about Kedusha, they're just talking about not blocking energy, just so that there's a flow of energy. They get it. And when we talk in a shul, it's not just about Feng Shui, we're not just talking about there being a flow of energy, we're talking about a specific type of energy. How do you bring Kedusha into the space and allow the Kedusha to flow freely in that space? That's what a shul is. And that's what one would want to see at a Kursal HaMa'arovi. So you've got the surroundings of the Beis HaMikdash, and you move across that boundary, and now you're in a different rishus. Now you're in a different space. And you go further, and you come into the area where only the Kohanim are allowed. And you go further, and you come into the Heichal, which is Kodesh, where even the Kohanim only go for specific practices at specific times. And then you have the Kodesh Kodoshim, where only the Kohen Gadol goes, and only on Yom Kippur. And what's in the Kodesh HaKodoshim? So you go through the Paroches, there's a curtain there. You would go through the curtain, and inside there you'll find the Oron. And what is the Oron? The Oron is a triple box. Well, it's a gold box with a wooden box inside it and another gold box inside it. So it's three boxes with a lid. And on the lid is a golden solid lid with the Kruvim, the two angels as described in next week's parasha. And what's inside the box? The luchos. The luchos are inside the box. And when do you take those luchos out? So you come to shul and you see there's a curtain. And you know, as a kid, you would kind of wait. When's the curtain going to open? And what's there behind? And the curtain would open. And this beautiful Sefer Torah. And the Torah would come out. That was part of the whole, that's part of the whole deal. When do you take the luchos out of the box?
Never.
What's that all about? You've got a book, you've got a work there, you've got a museum piece, a one in the world. Nobody's ever allowed to see it, ever. So what's it doing? What's its function? See, we think that if you can't use something, if you can't see something and touch it, and it doesn't have any... We've become, and that's what we're going to be talking about this evening, we've become so used to things being thrown at us, we don't even see things that aren't thrown at us, because so much is thrown at us. We don't even see everything that is thrown at us, we see only a very small proportion of what is thrown at us. You used to go to a movie and it was black and white, and you had to imagine the color. Then they made it technicolor, and you didn't have to imagine the color. And the sound wasn't that good. Then they had three-dimensional sound, and now there's surround sound, so the sound's coming from all over the place. You don't even have to imagine that the sound that you're hearing on the screen actually is coming from off the screen. You don't even have to use your imagination. It's now thrown at you. You get the sound. And now we've got 3D. So the stuff is actually in your face, right? Out of the screen, in your face. So you don't even have to put your head into the screen. The screen comes out at you. We just more and more are we reacting to things being thrown at us. And rather than for us seeking, for us deciding and going out and seeking what we want to find and where we want to find it and what we want to spend our time on. And if something isn't thrown at us, we don't give it value. If something isn't advertised to the nth degree, we don't recognize it. It doesn't have value unless it's advertised to the nth degree. It's thrown at us, then we kind of get it. Maybe this is something worth taking notice of. But it's not by a pull. The process in chol, in modern chol, modern general life, the process is push, it's not pull. The supplier pushes his product. And the one who pushes the hardest and the fastest is the one who has the most chance of being noticed and utilized and purchased. Kodesh is a power of pull, as you're going to see. And there's no push at all. When am I going to see the luchos? Never. That's when you're going to see the luchos. Never. They're not there for looking at. So what are they there for? They're there for feeling. Can you feel the luchos? If you can see them all the time, you don't feel. If you see them, then there's no part. If it's thrown at you and thrown at you and thrown at you, the seeing is the first. It's the most superficial sense we have. There's nothing more superficial than the visual. You just see the surface. You can't see anything beneath the surface. So if our visual is constantly being stimulated, as it is today, that whatever we're doing, it's the visual that's being stimulated, what chance is there of us really getting to any kind of depth of what we're doing? So comes the luchos, and with the luchos, you're never going to see it. There's no visual stimulation. Not only aren't you going to see the luchos, you aren't going to see the aura. Not only aren't you going to see the Oren, you're not going to see inside the Kodesh Kedoshim. Only one man's going to get inside the Kodesh Kedoshim, and it's not you. Moshe, can I ask you to turn the air conditioning on instead of the heating? Just turn the air on. I think it'll just because it'll get hotter and hotter otherwise. Thanks.
Is the look a magnet for Kedusha?
So the whole idea of Kedusha is magnetic rather than push. So that when we talked about spiritual power, what I'm putting before you tonight is that spiritual power is a magnetic power. It's a pull power. It's not a push power. Chol is a push power. Kodesh is a pull power. So let's look at it further. The Klei Yochor says that one of the reasons that it stresses twice that you've got to put the lid on the box, on the Oren. And it's interesting, where does the word Oren come from? So the Medrash says, interesting Medrash, Ma ha'or kodom l'chol ma'aseh bereishis, in the same way as Or came before the rest of bereishis. So, was the very first thing. Also in the Mishkan as well, Torah, which is the Oren, comes first, because the Torah is light, the Torah is energy. But what Rabbeinu Bechaya and others say is that even the word Oren, you know, we think Oren means a box, or Oren means a cupboard. That's because we take it from here. This is the first time the word is used. But it's used here not as an orem meaning a cup. It's here, used here as an orem meaning ur. It's a provider of energy. This is a generator. That's what the orem is. We look at this as a generator, as a very powerful generator of spiritual power. That's what orem is. So, and we're told, put the lid on, says the Kleyoko, Shetzorich L'chasois, Soidois HaTorah. You've got to cover the secrets of Torah. Don't advertise them. Just look how contrary that is to the way we're living today, even with Torah. Don't advertise the secrets of Torah. Keep them quiet. Why? Because Kovod Elokim Hester Dover, Posuk from Mishle. Because God's honor is through hiding things, not through glaring them, not through throwing them out. There is no honor and dignity in publicity. Publicity, in fact, cheapens. Publicity says, I need you. And what does God say? You need me, not I need you. So when we take Torah and we publicize it and we make it readily available, I'm not being critical of all the wonderful works that have been done recently in terms of the various art scrolls and various different translations and ways of making the Torah accessible to everybody. All that is good in terms of accessibility, in terms of it's done a whole lot of good, but one also has to see the obvious side of it. It's also cheapened. It's also made the Torah cheap. You don't have to go looking for it now. Now you can take out your iPhone and you can press an app and it'll start reading the Daf Yomi to you in English. And if you want to go a shir, you just tap and it'll tell you where the nearest shir is and you can wander into the shir and there you'll find some rabbi droning on the daf and it's the same, the daf after the one you heard yesterday in another city altogether. And it's just all, it's all very easy and it's all very accessible, which on the one hand is unbelievably wonderful and on the other hand is incredibly disturbing. It used to be you would come into a town and you would say, where can I get a good shir? Who gives the best shir in this town? And they'll say, well, the best shir is Rabbi so-and-so, but you know, you can't just get in there. It's not that easy. No, but I've got to go. I've got to, if he's the best, I've got to go. Well, then you better go and speak to him, see if he'll be okay with your coming in. You'll go and see the rabbi. I'll say, yeah, you know, but I'm learning. What are you learning? You're learning Bava Metzia. I'm learning Ksuvos at the moment. Well, you're not in it, so you'll pretend. So I'll prepare. Tell me where we are. I'll spend a couple of hours preparing before the shir. Okay, you'll spend a few hours preparing before the shir. That's how Torah used to be. You went seeking it. That's what drosha means, doresh. You seek. Torah was about seeking, not about having it shoved, and you just have to turn on your app to find out where to turn on the tap, and it all comes pouring out. That's not what it was. So again, it's paradoxical because there's some wonderful aspects about what's happening, and I don't want to trivialize that in any kind of a way. But at the same time, we have to understand what qualitative dimensions we've lost in the process. And what that is doing to us, and how, as individuals at least, we can try and recover that. So the Kleyoker says, "Tzorich l'chasos soidos haTorah, cover the soidos haTorah. Don't reveal them." The Arachayim says that nesudim hayushom ad olam, that the luchos are kept in that box forever. Never let them out, because when you hold something in, doesn't it sound like last week? Hold it in. Don't let it out. Because when you've got the wisdom, but it's hard to access, your actual is less than your potential. Your potential is much more than your actual. What's in the box is much bigger than what's out of the box. So what happens to a box when you know that what's in the box is much more than what's out of the box? What happens? People crowd around it. They're attracted to it. You're not attracted to something that has less inside than it has outside. That repels. You're attracted to something that has more inside than has outside. That's what attraction is. That's the people you're attracted to. You're attracted to a person. You look at the person. You speak to the person. You just feel this person has so much more than meets the eye. That's when you're attracted. But in our modern society, particularly in American society, if the person's got more than meets the eye, poor person, they will be ignored. They will go down. They will not go down in history. You will never have heard of them. Because we don't take any notice of people who've got more than hits the eye. We only take notice of that which hits the eye, and only some of what hits the eye. It has to hit the eye really loud and really hard, and then maybe we'll notice it. But the real gems, when you get to Kedusha, it's not thrown at the eye. It's beneath the surface. You've got to mine it. Where's gold? Look how you've got to go. Those of us that come from South Africa know what it is to mine gold. 4 or 5 miles under the ground, to pull out a ton of rock in order to get as much as the tip of a teaspoon full of gold. That's the labor that has to go into seeking out the gold. It's not going to be thrown at you. You're not going to find. That's where if you want gold, that's where you go. There's a lesson in that. What's the Rebbeinu Shem telling us? The most precious of things, you've got to mine. You've got to find them. You've got to prospect for them. Figure out where they are. And sometimes you try and you dig and it isn't there. You thought it was there. Then you stop and you go somewhere else and you start digging again until you find it. And then you stay there and you work it and you refine it until you've got your gold. That's how it is with the good things in life. But that's not the way we operate in the area of Chol, and that's why the Beis HaMikdash is Amavdil in Kodesh L'Chol. Learn those differences and how to manage those differences. Let's go even further into this, and that's the Kruvim. The Kruvim are the cherubs. What we do know about them is they're in the form of angels, and the image of angels, an angel is a spiritual force. And an angel doesn't have an image. It can appear in an image, but it's a spiritual force, and it can manifest in all sorts of different ways. If Hashem wants to send you a message, he might send you the message in the form of another person who just tells you something that gives you insight, that just enlightens you. And that could be an angel. That doesn't mean that person is an angel. It means the force through which Hashem sent you that message. That was the force of the angel. But the image we use is this being with a childlike face, a human face, a very innocent human face, and wings. That's the kind of image of the angel. And the Kruvim were designed in that image. And some of the things that we see. So firstly, we see that the Kruvim is an angel and has the face of a child. The Kruvim, by the way, represent male and female, so we've got those two, that polarity there again. On the very Orin, we have this male and female polarity. With what in between? What do we need to have in between? That bris, which keeps the forces in balance. And what do we know was in between the Kruvim? The Shekhinah, Hashem's voice came from there. So that's where you've got the whole Shekhinah, and that's why when a man and a woman get together, Hashem is the third partner in that relationship. Otherwise, they would consume each other. That's why we say Ish and Isha without the Yud-K, without taking the Yud-K out of Ish and Isha, you've got fire. They'll destroy each other. These are two powerful energies that are held in balance by the dimension of Kedusha, which is Hashem's presence. And we have that in the Orin itself. You've got the two Kruvim, a male and female Kruv, with the power of Hashem in the middle, keeping that balance. And that's the power of the Shekhinah. And these angels look very innocent, and they're angelic. And again, the Klei Yochor, you see, Dr. Gift, we're using your favorite Mefarish tonight. The Klei Yochor says, based on a pasuk in Malachi, where the Novi says, "Ki malach v'toro yevakshu mipihu," and they will ask, they will seek Torah from his mouth. Notice the words, "Yevakshu Torah mipihu." It's very, very different. Nowadays, don't the yeshivas send out people here to recruit students? Does that happen? Mm-hmm. Do you have people who come out recruiting students?
Mm-hmm.
They get that from the universities. That's not Torah. Torah is Yevakshu Mipiyu. Students go over and they plead with yeshivas to accept them. The whole of the relationship, until yeshivas started recruiting, that was the end of the Kedushas HaTorah in the way that yeshivas managed their students in that particular area. So it started becoming a marketplace where the student becomes the customer. Instead of a place of Kedusha, which is different altogether. Torah Yevakshu Mipiyu. So the Novi says that Torah Yevakshu Mipiyu Ki Malach Hashem Tzvahusu, because he's an angel of God. And it's the Kovnerov explains that and says, if you have to go and seek the Torah out from him, from this yeshiva or this Rav, this Rosh Yeshiva, that's a sign he's a Malach Hashem. That's the sign. The Torah he teaches comes from God. If you don't have to seek it, he's busy shouting out, he's busy recruiting, he's busy trying to tell you to come, then that's not Malach Hashem. That's another force, that's his own ego, that's his own Torah, it's coming from him. So it's fine, you can go and learn it, but that's not Malach Hashem. Ki malach Hashem v'Torah yevakshu mipiu. You know that he's a malach Hashem when Torah yevakshu mipiu. When the only way to get the Torah is to go and seek it out. So it's the bakosha satur, it's the derisha satur. Those words that we have, asei lecho rav, doesn't say asei lecho talmid. It says asei lecho rav. Go and make yourself a rabbi. It doesn't say the rabbis must make talmidim. Emidu talmidim abei. From your talmid, you must make many of them. But you don't go out recruiting them. Talmidim have to recruit a rav, not a rav recruits a talmid. Just look how distorted we've gone. Look how we've lost it. And then we wonder why we're so confused and we're so, because we've lost the essence of it. As we've gotten more meticulous about the Shmiras HaMitzvahs, which is very important and wonderful that we are more meticulous about it, I don't know about more meticulous, but there's a growing consciousness of being frum, of keeping the mitzvahs, and that's wonderful. But at that same time, we're wandering so far away from the essence of Kedusha, of what Kedusha Satara really is. So what do we have here? Here we have this double image, the image of the luchos hidden away in a box that nobody ever opens. You can feel its effect, but you'll never see it. And in fact, part of the reason you can feel it is because you'll never see it. And it's something worth practicing sometimes is to, it's good for couples to do as well, is to sometimes sit in the dark where you can't see and communicate without words and without vision. And see what you can pick up. I once went to a very interesting workshop, and I was intrigued by the topic of the workshop. The topic of the workshop was to build intuitive power and ability. So I thought I went to the woman who was running that workshop at a venue where I happened to be. I said, "Is this? Are you serious? How long is your session?" She said, "It's an hour." I said, "In an hour, you're going to tell me how to build my intuition?" She said, "Absolutely." So I said, "Okay, do you mind if I listen? I'm intrigued." She said, "Sure." So we go inside, and she gives us some techniques of just being able to relax, just some very basic breathing and meditational techniques to be able to relax, teaches us how to do that. Then she says to everybody, pick somebody next to you who you don't know, you've had no previous contact with, and exchange an object. So there's an elderly woman sitting next to me, and I think I gave her my cell phone, and she gave me her watch. Well, I suppose I don't remember exactly. She says, "Right, now hold on to this and tell the other person what you feel. Not what you think, what you feel. What emotions are you feeling?" So I said to her, "I feel pain and loss." She said, "Wow." She said, "I lost my husband recently and I'm in terrible pain." I said, "What do you feel?" She said, "I feel," holding on to my cell phone or whatever it was, "I feel unsettledness and travel." And travel. How do you do that? Where does that come from? If you're not seeing, if you're not focused on what's being thrown at you, you can allow yourself to feel. And what you can feel is unbelievable if you allow yourself to feel. You don't have to see, you don't have to talk, you don't have to communicate, you can pick up energy. If we just allow ourselves the space and the silence to be able to do that, that was the luchos. The Kodshi HaKadoshim. And that's what you need to do when you're in a shul. That's why it's a terrible thing when people speak in shul. It just destroys the possibility of other people. It's such geneva. It's such theft of opportunity. How much opportunity have you got just to sit and feel? Just feel the words. There's Lauren Kodesh there. There's Sifrei Torah there. The opportunity just to feel. How much time have we got for that? And to have, and especially when the conversation's different, chol, and just it just dissipates that energy, and it's impossible to access that energy when that's happening. So this idea of the orin containing luchos which are never seen but felt, and now a talmid chacham represented by the kruvim, who's a malach Hashem because you know about him by the force of attraction, not by what he throws at you. By what he throws at you, that's not the Malach Hashem Tzvos. You know about him by what? Because there's that force of attraction. What are you attracted by? The fact that he contains more than he gives. The fact that there's more potential than actual. The fact that there's more under the surface than on the surface. Those are the things that pull you in. That's what pulls you in. The same as the Oruv. That's it. Torah Yevakshu Mipiyu. Then you bakosh satur. You want to learn more. So you want to ask questions. That's why our whole methodology in Torah is asking questions. In secular methodology, in American education, who asks the questions?
The teacher.
So ask the question. And who gives the answers?
The teacher.
That's it. The teacher asks the questions, the teacher gives the answer, and the child learns on by rote and has to give back what they learned. Is that a learning process? And how does it work in the Gemara? Who asks the question? The Talmid asks the question. The one who wants to learn, the question is the tool for seeking. It's the tool for being doresh. When you want to research something, when you want to get more knowledge, you ask the questions. That's the way you vakshu Torah mipiyu. That's how you learn Torah. Is you find somebody who has more underneath the surface than on the surface. Because if it's all on the surface, there are no questions. A question means it's under the surface. A question means it's potential, it's not actual. It's the answer to the question which converts it from potential to actual. So if you're learning from somebody who puts out more than they've got inside them, what's there to ask? You just sit quietly and you listen. And that's what shiurim have become. Somebody listened to last week's shiur. Somebody overseas listened to last week's shiur and said, it's not their kind of shiur. I said, well, they said, they don't like to think when they go to a shiur. They don't like to have to think. They said, the people at your shiur must be incredibly clever. They must be really, really bright. I said, why? Why so bright? They are bright, but why do you think they must be so bright? No, because they have to think to understand it. That's not what I want to go to a shiur. I want to be inspired in a shiur. So that means you want everything thrown at you. That's not kedusha. That's not Torah, it's a lecture. It's a great lecture. But that's not Torah, that's not a shiur, that's not learning. Learning is when you've got a question, you're asking yourself as you're listening, you ask each other, you ask the teacher. There's a process of going, you're unraveling, you're trying to discover things beneath the surface because you know, you sense, there's a whole lot under there. You're looking at these psukim and you feel there's a world under these psukim that I can't see. And you want to look, so you ask questions, you notice funny things, and you look in the Rashi, and you look in the Ramban, and you don't understand. It's clear that the Ramban's saying much more than is on the surface. So now what do? We do it, look at an English translation. What does an English translation tell you? At best, if it's a really good English translation, it tells you what's on the surface. It can't do any more. That's the nature of a translation. And the whole process of questioning and discovery is gone. And that's what this is about. The Mishkan is there to set up a model of how we operate. And now let's go one last step further. And that is, you remember I brought you a Chazal last week that was a little disturbing, where the Chazal said that, Gemara and Chagiga, that money, children, and health are not the result of one's own good deeds. You can be a good person and you can have bad luck in those areas, and you can be a bad person and you can have good luck in those areas. It's not the result of your deeds. And so the question is, what is it the result of? Doesn't matter. All sorts of forces. It might be because you had a great grandfather that was a wonderful person. It might be because of coincidence, random coming together. It might be because through you, Hashem wants to do something for somebody else. There can be a million reasons why a bad person has some good luck, and there can be a million reasons why a good person has some bad luck, and that's why we call it mazel. It doesn't mean luck, it just means it's not directly correlated to your own efforts or to your own to your own zchuyos. And that's just something that we have to accept. The question then is, so what can we do? So I think a number of people ask me, so what do we do? Does that mean we're impotent? We have no power to affect anything? Here's the answer. If you look at the Kruvim, what does it say about the Kruvim? Where are they facing? They have an interesting angle to them. So if I say Kruv Echad Mikatzeh Mizeh, Kruv Echad Mikatzeh Mizeh, one kruv on this side, one kruv on that side. Vo you are kruvim porsei chnofayim lamala. They spread their wings upwards. Soichachim bechanfein ala kaporis, covering the kaporis with their wings. So do you see two different directions, two different angles? There's an upward angle and there's a downward angle. They're covering the lid. They're on top of the lid. So you've got the aron. The lid, on top of the lid are these two kruvim with these big wings spread out over the kaporis. So not only are the luchis covered with the kaporis, but on top of the kaporis, built into the kaporis, are these two kruvim whose wings cover the kaporis. So that they cover the kaporis, that's a downward thing, they're covering what's beneath them, and they're they're angled upwards. Ufneihem ishel echuf. And their face is one to the other. Ela kaporis yupnei akrivim, facing the kaporis. So they're kind of facing down and looking at each other. And their wings are up and down. So they're all these kind of dual angles in the way that these kruvim are positioned. And what is it? So again, says our friend the Klei Yocher, Pursek nafayim lamalo, that is their relationship to Hashem. Ish el ochiv, each one to the other, is their relationship to one another, ben odom lechaveru. And ela kapuris is the relationship to the Torah. And I just want to read the actual words of the Klei Yocher on that. Kilotzeis yidei shomayim, to do their obligations for Hashem, hayu hakruvim poshech nafayim lemala, their wings were angled upwards. Velotzeis yidei chavis habriyus, and because they have obligations to one another, hayu pneim ishelochiv, they faced each other, hamore gamal hasholim, hanitzan lo'aveyatur, which is the peace and the tranquility that has to be. The Shechina is only where there is halacha, the Klei Yocher says at the beginning, where Ein lo lakush baruch el adalat armas shel halacha, you will only find the Shechina where there's halacha. And based on last week, what does that mean? With the four amos of halacha, what does that mean? Where chemdo is completely constrained. If chemdo is constrained, and don't forget, I think I made the point last week, but if I didn't, I want to make it again this week. It doesn't say the 10th commandment is not loy tachmid. I know that's what it says on the shuls. When you look in there, it says loy tachmid. It says loy tachmid es beis reyecho beis eishes shorachecho beis eishes reyecho. There are certain things you can't be chomed. The prohibition is not chemdo. You mustn't have ego. You mustn't have a chemdo. That's not what it says. It just says, don't direct your chemdo to things that are not yours. Direct your chemdo to the things that are yours. That's the important part of Loi Tachmo, the other aspect of it too. So if you look at when it says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Shechino is where there are the four amos of halacha, means where things are clearly defined and our ego is in check, and we've got all this buildup of energy directed at ourselves and what is ours and what is our responsibility, not directed at what is not our responsibility and what does not belong to us. Just think of how much energy is directed by people, including ourselves, at things we can't change. And we talk about it, and we write about it, and we complain about it. And so much energy. Just keep it inside. Keep all that energy for the things that are yours to change. That's where you build it. Forget about that. The rest of it, you don't have to express it. You can feel it, but don't express it. It's not necessary to express it. You dissipate. Every time you express, you dissipate. Keep that energy inside. And then, they face the kaporis, their whole focus of their attention, these kruvim, is in the Torah that's inside the orin, not like those who are chachomim in their own eyes. There are two types of chachomim, a true chachom and a self-appointed chachom. And not like the self-appointed chacham. The doshim lichved atzma. And their droshes are for their own honor. The lo lichved atzma, not for the Torah. And I tell you that those phrases of the Klei Yocher are the most challenging element of any teacher of Torah. There is nothing more, there is no Tosfos or Rashi or Sugya of Gemara harder than that. To question and figure, when you're teaching, are you teaching because you want people to go away and say, wow, that was a great shiur? Or are you teaching because you want people to go away and say, wow, the Torah is amazing? What do you want? If they went away and thought, it was a waste of time, the shiur, but the Torah, wow, what I didn't realize from the shiur is the Torah, would that satisfy you? It's one of the hardest things to confront. And look at how he defines you if the deep intention of your teaching is for your own covet, that's a chacham be'enayim. That's somebody, you're a chacham in your own eyes. It's a self-reflected chacham. It's one of the hardest things to try and cleanse oneself of the sense, because when one teaches, if you're doing a good job teaching, there's wonderful feedback, and people say shukar, people say it was wonderful, and you begin to think, you begin to take it seriously. You begin to say that, think they're saying shukar to you, and you don't realize they're saying shukar to the Torah. It's not you, you're just teaching what's here, you're just teaching what you were taught. It's not you. But it's very hard to keep that in mind. And it's critical, and that's what those kruvim are there to remind us of. Now, what's the good of them reminding us if we never see them? So how do we remember? Because we learn about them. The Torah is about learning. You don't have to see it all. It's not about seeing. It's about learning. The seeing is the tip of the iceberg. You want to learn the whole thing, and that's why we say, Shlishim Yom Kodem Achag, 30 days before a Yom Tov, learn the Masechta. Immerse yourself in the concepts of the Yom Tov. Then when you come to the Yom Tov, it's very beautiful to see it in actuality, but that's not the real thing. It's not the matzah that you eat on Pesach. Yeah, that's the mitzvah, but all the pages of Gemara and the Forashim and everything that goes into what matzah is, and why, and how, and when, and where. That's what changes you. It's not eating the matzah that changes you. After you've learned Masech the Psochim, you then eat matzah. That has impact. But just to go through the tradition of eating the matzah, because it's kind of Seder night, and that's what you do. It's a nice cultural activity, but what's it? Why is it going to change you? It's pleasant, keeps the family together, keeps the tradition going. All very nice, that's good, but lots of cultures do those kind of things. That's not Torah. Torah is to be able to learn. You don't have to see it. The physical part of it is the least important part of it. That's why, as we said in the first year that we had in this series, was that the Torah existed before the world even existed. There weren't physical things and all these concepts already existed. The concepts have a reality in and of themselves. And so it is with the luchos. The luchos are there, whether you see them or not is not important. The kruvim are there. And there's a message in those kruvim. What is the message? The kind of Talmid Chochem. It's back again to the message of the nature of the Talmid Chochem who's teaching, that teaching is one of attraction rather than casting out, rather than projection. It's of wanting to find out. It's of wanting to be derish. That the person teaching, the person learning and teaching Torah has that angelic aspect to him, where it's that you want to access. You want to access the Torah, and you want to access it more and more as you go along. That's really the important part of what we're looking at. So if we summarize it, what are we saying? Last week we were saying, chemdo is that power. What is the purpose of ego? Why did God create ego? God created ego as a force to build up. Firstly, we utilize it in certain areas, but apart from that, that ego force is that reservoir that we build up of energy. That we don't focus on ourselves, who do we focus it on? It's true when the Gemara says, my own efforts and my own zchuyos are not going to make me wealthy. But could I make somebody else wealthy through my efforts? Oh, yes, I can. I can put somebody else in business. I can give somebody tzedakah. I can do a chesed for somebody else. And I can impact their lives. Can't impact mine. I can impact theirs. Can I do something? Can I raise your children to be tzaddikim? Yes, I can. And we all know that we're more successful with other people's children than with our own. That's how it is. The Gemara tells us that. And that our children grow up despite us, not because of us, despite us. They grow up because they've got some good road, they've got some good role models to go to. But we know that very often that many Rabbonim whose Talmidim were greater than their own children, that it doesn't go down inherited. That's not the way it works. Because we have no control over how our children come out. We can create environments and we can guide them. But there's no guarantees. There's some wonderful people whose children get all funny. And there's some very ordinary people whose children are amazing. And we see it over and over again in life. There's no correlation. But there is correlation between a Rebbe and his Talmidim. That there's correlation for. And what about health? Can I impact your health? Yes, I can. That's what a doctor does. Impact somebody else's health. You can save somebody else's life. Can I do it for myself? No, not really. There are halachas. I've got to work even though I can't control my income. If I don't work, there's nothing. So there's a halacha. You've got to work. You've got to go through the effort. But that doesn't necessarily guarantee outcome. You've got to raise your children and you've got to educate them and you've got to invest in them. But that doesn't guarantee outcome. And you've got to take care of your health, and you've got to invest in your health and take care of it in the best way you know how to. But that doesn't care. That doesn't guarantee outcome. There are people who take very good care of their health. They die young. It can happen. Why? Who knows why? It's muzzle. It doesn't correlate. But when we're working with one another, it does correlate. So isn't that interesting? The only time we can really impact is with what we do for others. What we do for ourselves has little impact. And what do we spend most of our lives working on? Ourselves. What a tragedy. To realize that we have so much spiritual energy to change the world with, and we spend that on ourselves. Yes, we need to develop ourselves. I'm not suggesting we don't need to do it. We do, but we need to know that developing ourselves has no guaranteed outcome. But developing other people does have guaranteed outcome. And that's why on three things, the Torah stands on three things. What are they, says the Mishnah? What are the three things that the Klal Yochel mentions with these angels? They face each other. That's Gemilus Chasodim. They face their wings face upwards. That's Avodah. And their eyes are down to Torah. Never looking at themselves. Their eyes aren't looking at themselves. Their wings aren't towards themselves. Their fingers, they don't feature. Everything's outward. It's the Torah. It's God. It's other people. That's the focus of energy. Now, if we do that, then we become conduits. So try and picture it as a circuit. So think of these angels on the Orin. They're focused on the Torah, drawing energy from the Torah, projecting it onto their friend, onto others, Gemilus Chasodim, and the result of that is their wings are open to a force that comes from Hashem and gives them energy from Hashem. So the way to get that energy is from focusing on the Torah and on the other. The way to get the energy, you can't get the energy from focusing on yourself. You'll always get energy from what you give, not from what you take. And it's interesting, my whole business is dedicated to teaching businessmen, and it's amazing how they get it. That wealth is created by what you give, not by what you get. What you get doesn't build wealth. What you get is an outcome of what you give. That's what business is. Business is giving a customer more than he pays for. That's when you keep customers. Business is giving a shareholder more than he invested. Business is giving a creditor more than he lent you. Business is giving an employee more than the value of his labor. That's what it is. If you give the employee more than the value of his labor, and you give a customer more than the cost of the goods, and you give an investor more than the money he invested, you've got a sustainable business. It's all about giving them more than they're giving you. Not about taking more than they're giving you. It's about giving more. That's the way the world is built. Olam chesed yibone. The world is designed so that it thrives when people are building each other, not building themselves. You build yourself as an outcome because you're the conduit. And as God's energy flows through you, you build yourself. You build your spiritual stature. But that's the result of the circuit being closed. So that the energy is flowing from the Torah out to the world, to Hashem, back to me. And so it goes around. But that's the focus. That's how the energy circulates through the world. And so we see that there's a need not only to be conscious of the reshuyos in terms of I can't take something that isn't mine, I can't covet something that isn't mine, but then there are the spiritual reshuyos, the kodesh and the chol, and then it goes beyond not taking something which isn't mine, and it goes into the realm of giving. And that's why right after Mishpatim, what do we have? Ask everybody for trumas. Now that you've understood Mishpatim and you've got all of this built and you realize that this is not built to dissipate. It's built there. When you give, it doesn't dissipate. It dissipates when you spend it on yourself. That's ego. When you spend your wealth, whether it's spiritual wealth or intellectual wealth or time or money, when you project your wealth and invest it in others, that doesn't dissipate. That actually builds. That builds the reserves. It doesn't dissipate the reserves. The only times the reserves are dissipated is when we spend it on ourselves. So now the structure of the Torah is perfect, even though it's not chronological. It doesn't matter that it's not chronological. Aseres Hadibros, Le'tachmud as the pinnacle of Aseres Hadibros, all builds up from Anachi Hashem Lekecha to the final one, which is the essence of the driver of everything, Le'tachmud. Mishpatim to teach you how to be Mekayim Lo Tachmud, and once you know how to be Mekayim Lo Tachmud, you can now give Truma, because you've got reserves. You're not dissipated. Now you can take what you've built as reserves and you can invest. And you can invest it spiritually. When you're investing it spiritually and you're seeking Torah, you understand the power of seeking rather than the power of things being thrown at you. You understand the power of the Orin. You understand the power of the two Kruvim. You understand the angle at which they operate. You understand the circuit of energy that comes when your focus is to make the Torah great. Your outward projection is to your fellow man. And you have your hands open to receive energy from Hashem, and then the circuit of energy, of spiritual energy, operates. And so we've got the Torah building up beautifully from Yisro and Mishpatim and through to Truah.
Mm-hmm. All right.